Hey there, Backstory listeners. This is from the show's archives.
Major funding for Backstory is provided by an anonymous donor, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation.
From Virginia Humanities, this is Backstory. Welcome to Backstory, the show that explains the history behind today's headlines. I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Ballow.
If you're new to the podcast, we're all historians, and each week, along with our colleagues Joanne Freeman and Nathan Connolly, we explore a different aspect of American history.
Now, close your eyes, relax your body, and take a deep breath. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out.
And we thought we'd start you off this week with a little meditation, courtesy of your favorite meditation teacher, Brian Ballow.
Yes, Ed, you're the only person I know who speaks while he meditates. Let's try it again. Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out.
I'm afraid you've put all our audience to sleep, Brian.
Wouldn't be the first time, Ed.
So meditation has gone mainstream recently, promoted by the likes of Oprah Winfrey and Jay-Z. It's part of a broader wellness craze that's taken over the country and making lots of money. Recent estimates have it that the global wellness industry is worth some $4.2 billion and growing.
This week on Backstory, we decided to dive into the history of wellness and explore practices that were embraced or rejected throughout history.
We'll bring you the story of Dr. John Harvey Kellogg, who brought Seventh-day Adventist theology to his wellness center in the late 1800s.
And we'll learn about how Dr. Sigmund Freud's one and only visit to America carried psychoanalysis across the Atlantic. What you're hearing is a clip from a local aerobics class. Don't worry, I'm not wearing my leotard. People, mostly women, sweating it out, dancing and jumping around to a choreographed routine. Today, aerobics has been eclipsed by more popular kinds of exercise, like CrossFit and yoga. But it used to be all the rage.
Aerobics was very popular in the 1980s, and there's a few ways that we can see this. One is simply by looking at the ways in which it emerges in popular culture and popular discussion of the decades.
That's Jenny Ellison. She's a historian who specializes in the history of aerobics and activism.
We have films like Perfect featuring Jamie Lee Curtis and John Travolta sharing these kind of seductive glances in aerobics classes. We see the rise of competitive aerobics, like the Crystal Light National Aerobics Championships, where, you know, instructors go and they compete. And so we just see this sort of emergence of aerobics as part of the culture and part of the discussion. Another way we can see it is through the popularity of someone like Jane Fonda. So between 1982 and 1987, Fonda sold 4 million copies of her workout videos in the United States alone.
Jenny says aerobics might seem frivolous on the surface, but it actually grew out of some big changes happening in American fitness and American culture.
So first, what we see in the 1960s is growing awareness of the benefits, the health benefits of cardiovascular exercise and the rise of sports like running that become increasingly popular through the 1970s. So there's a greater understanding of the value of physical fitness. we see a transformation in the kinds of sport and leisure activities that become popular with the baby boomers. The baby boomers are the first generation raised on play. And as they come of age in the 70s and 1980s, we see these sports crazes like jogging, like aerobics. We see new leisure activities that are playful, but they're for adults. And I would say aerobics is part of that overall trend of bringing greater playfulness and fun to adult exercise. And lastly, I'd say a big part of it is it's an outgrowth of this feminist sport movement. Title IX is an example of that, an outcome of that activism. But just in a general sense that part of women's liberation is a bodily liberation that gives them opportunities to play sport.
But not all women were on board with aerobics. Although it developed alongside second-wave feminism, some women took issue with the culture it perpetuated.
The feminist critique of aerobics is that it encourages a culture of display where women are encouraged to adopt a feminine appearance rather than focusing on their physical fitness. If we look at representations of aerobics, especially pop culture representations, and I want to emphasize that there here because we don't have images of women in rec centers and church basements doing aerobics. But if we think of the popular image of aerobics, it's Jane Fonda. And although Fonda positioned herself as, you know, she positioned herself as an ally to her audience. And, you know, I'm just like you. I'm looking for exercise to make me feel good. It was a way to achieve bodily liberation through self-control. Feminists didn't see it that way. They saw Fonda as a slim white woman who was perpetuating this norm and this pressure to be slender among American women.
For many women, the Jane Fonda look was impossible to achieve, no matter how many classes they attended or how many diets they tried out. But it didn't stop some from adapting aerobics to make it their own.
So in the 1980s, as part of the fat activist movement, we see the rise of aerobics classes created by fat women, taught by fat women, and attended by fat women. And so this is aerobics for fat women only. So the term fat, it just depended on the person. So the aerobics movement, you know, it takes different shapes across time and in different places. So the groups that I studied often use the word large, but we also see examples of the use of the term fat. In California in particular, there's a really robust and exciting fat activist movement from the late 1960s. And the aerobics classes that were popular there, you know, were a branch out of that community of feminists in California who were critiquing feminine and bodily norms. And aerobics for fat women only emerged from this movement because it emerged with this idea that, you know, fat women should have safe spaces to exercise. There's no single starting point for it. It gets taken up by women in different parts of the United States and Canada in different places. And many of these women didn't even know that other people were doing the same thing. What they do in general is they have an instructor who gets training or is trained as an aerobics teacher, and they invite other like-minded women, or they advertise classes for fat women. They use images of larger women in the ads to draw women in, and they begin teaching these classes, and they became quite popular through the 1980s, and we see them in most American states and several Canadian provinces.
Deb Burgard was one of those women leading fitness classes for fat women in the 1980s. She was inspired by West African and Middle Eastern dance classes she'd taken, where the focus was on having fun and building community, not losing weight. But then Deb relocated to the Bay Area, and what was initially a setback quickly became an opportunity.
I was kind of looking around and thinking, you know, I'm not finding any places where larger people are going to feel like the activity is really paced for them. And I was thinking about how the traditional aerobics classes that I was seeing, I was trying to kind of try on the idea in my mind of, is like jazzercise the sort of folk dance of our culture right now? Like, it's kind of a reflection of our culture, isn't it? It's sort of like, you know, and if this is the version of our folk dance right now, like, f*** it, you know, like, it's terrible. I started teaching my class and I called it We Dance. I was like, not going to have any cutesy you know, plays on words or anything. It's just like, we're going to dance. This is We Dance. Just that's what it's going to be called. And I was teaching it in Berkeley and Oakland, and I did advertise it as a dance class for women over 200 pounds. And I did that somewhat ambivalently because I didn't want anybody to be more weight focused, you know, or think that there had to be some sort of, you know, weighing before you can come into the class or something. But I really did want us to be very concrete about, you know, this is not a dance class for, you know, people who feel fat and who are not subject to these, you know, exposures to discrimination. I want this class to actually be paced for bodies that are heavier. And I want people to look around the room and see themselves in other people. And I want, you know, there to be this kind of saturation, you know, in our experience of each other, of people at higher body weights, you know, who are really just sort of seeing what it feels like to move in these bodies, and, you know, give the opportunity to people to come and party. And that's what we did. It was just so fun.
Deb says her classes were part of a broader movement with a radical vision.
There was a woman in San Francisco who had a class called Fat and Fit, and her name was Eliza Mimsky. The other class that was going on at the time, which was fabulous, was called Light on Your Feet, which was also in Oakland. It was the beginning of, just in my life, it was the beginning of my fat activism, for sure. Like, if you're a member of a stigmatized group, the world is always telling you how your body is wrong. And it's telling you, you have to do this in order for your body not to be wrong. And some of what they're telling you might be horrible information, but some of the information, like find a way to move, is not necessarily bad information. But if your experience as a member of that stigmatized group is that the movement is connected to repairing how your body is wrong, it's not going to be a good experience. It's going to be a traumatizing experience or a stigmatizing experience, right? And so I was trying to sort of think about, what is the best chance of a good memory of movement for people? And I thought, you know, a lot of people, at least some people, have had terrible experiences of PE, but better experiences of recess, you know? So I was thinking about, all right, so how do we bring back recess for adults, you know? But just really thinking about the idea of play as opposed to the idea of punishment, which is still a radical idea.
Nowadays, aerobics might not be the most popular class at your local gym, but Jenny and Deb say the fat aerobics movement offers some important lessons on wellness, public health messages, and body size.
I had to, you know, field a lot of calls. People would call about, get information about the class, and they would just disparage themselves and say, oh, I can't even climb up the stairs. I've gained 50 pounds, you know, I can't bring home my groceries, blah, blah, blah. And I would think to myself, well, just come to the class. You're going to see people who are 100 pounds heavier than you doing splits. So you'll get it that this is, you know, this is some perspective that you've been, you know, you've been fed from the dominant culture. And you need to see your family, you know, like your fat family. You need to see the fat family that you weren't born into. You need to see the beauty in this fat family and the people who are figuring out how to sort of make a way, even though there's so much bullshit that is kind of inherently there day by day. And there's just, it's like recognizing how brilliant people can be at resisting this stuff and finding each other and, you know, making a party happen, you know. I just wish I could transplant that experience into everybody's brain.
When we talk to people who participated in aerobics classes for fat women only, you know, what we learn is that women spent years and decades and sometimes a lifetime trying to lose weight and never did. And felt badly about this, and that it had a really negative impact on their interpersonal relationships. Once they had come to terms with the fact that they were fat and this was unlikely to change, they began to see their lives a lot differently. And so one of the questions that the movement raises for the medical profession is the general failure to find a solution for the challenge of obesity. So if we, you know, take the analysis that obesity is bad for people, the medical profession has actually never been able to find a clear solution to this problem. And so for decades, men and women have struggled to lose weight because of this sense that being fat is negative. And yet the data show us that diets are rarely successful. What fat activism and aerobics classes for fat women only offer is a different model. And that's a model of health at every size, where we meet people where they are. And we don't focus on weight. We focus on physical and mental wellness. And this is a different way of thinking about physical fitness and health than relying solely on metrics like weight to determine whether or not somebody is in good or bad shape.
That's Jenny Ellison. She's a curator of sport and leisure at the Canadian Museum of History and the author of several articles on aerobics and fat activism. You also heard Deb Burgard. She's a psychologist and fat activist. Deb is also one of the founders of the Health at Every Size model.
Brian, when you hear the name Kellogg, there's probably one thing that immediately jumps to mind.
Kellogg's for breakfast, no better way to start the day.
It's smiling food.
It's good for you.
Start you off with a hoop-de-doo.
It's Kellogg's for breakfast and a happy, happy day.
Well, Ed, I'm afraid that's a little before my time.
It's hard to imagine such a time, but I agree with
maybe
you.
Maybe after it. At any rate, what came to my mind was cornflakes.
Oh, yeah. And I can just picture the box and, you know, how happy you were to see it in the morning and breakfast. Sure. Today, Kellogg is synonymous with spoonfuls of crunchy, sugar-coated breakfast cereals. But back in the late 19th century, the name Kellogg was known not for its cereal as much as for its, yes, sanitarium. Your scholar, Brian C. Wilson.
The Battle Creek Sanitarium was, for a time, for many decades, in fact, probably the most famous health and wellness destination, not only in the United States, but it was known internationally.
You might have heard of a sanatorium, but sanitarium was a term made up by the man behind the whole operation, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg. He was put in charge of the facility in Battle Creek, Michigan, in 1876. At that time, it was called the much less appealing Western Health Reform Institute. But Kellogg had a different idea.
He just said, okay, it's now the Battle Creek Sanitarium. And somebody pointed out, well, sanitarium really isn't a word. It's sanatorium. And he said, well, it's a word I've coined because sanatoriums are places where people go to get well. And a sanitarium is a place where people come to learn how to stay well.
Now, at first glance, Dr. Kellogg may not have been the obvious pick for the director of a wellness center. He was a portly fellow who stood at a modest 5'4". But his church, the Seventh-day Adventist, singled him out as a leader at a young age and paid for him to attend medical school.
And so when he came back to Battle Creek in 1875, he was only 23, 24 years old, but he was the best qualified physician the Adventists had. And the idea here was that Ellen White had a vision that the Seventh-day Adventists should create a health reform institute in Battle Creek. Ellen White was a prophetess and a leader and had a series of health revelations that basically said that God felt that the Adventists needed to take better care of their health. There was a belief that you could only have a pure soul if you had a pure body. And John Harvey Kellogg promoted a vegetarian diet, and he believed that it was important not only for people's physical health, but also for their spiritual health.
A man that lives on pork, fine flour bread, rich pies and cakes and condiments, drinks tea and coffee, and uses tobacco, might as well try to fly as to be chaste in thought.
If you disregarded what he called the laws of life or the laws of health by abusing your body, by eating a bad diet or drinking alcohol or smoking, then you were not only harming yourself physically, but you were also basically offending God. And so there's a very kind of strong moral emphasis on Kellogg's physiology.
Disease is cured by the body itself, not by doctors or remedies. All the inventions and devices ever constructed by the human hand or conceived by the human mind, no matter how delicate, how intricate and complicated, are simple childish toys compared with that most marvelously wrought mechanism, the human body.
So what would you have experienced if you showed up in Battle Creek at the sanitarium? What would your arrival and day there have been like?
Well, people would actually come for weeks at a time, and it really became a kind of destination, a kind of resort. And by the 1890s, he'd built the thing into a huge kind of grand hotel complex of buildings, this giant kind of Victorian pile. And you would be admitted and have a preliminary consultation. And then based on that, they would basically tailor a kind of routine for you, both in terms of diet. And Dr. Kellogg was a real demon for exercise. He believed everybody needed to get far more exercise than they were getting. So they had a very large gymnasium. They had tennis courts and all sorts of things outside for people to do. But they also had a full laboratory, a pharmacy, all the things that you would see in a modern hospital. And so over a course of a couple of weeks, maybe even a month, people would basically eat the vegetarian diet, do the exercises, undergo a variety of different treatments, some of them quite novel. Dr. Kellogg was really interested in the properties of light and sunlight. So he created a kind of looks like the first tanning bed, the first light therapy bed. So it really depended on what the original diagnosis was, what your days at the sanitarium would be.
So what would be a typical diagnosis? What would be wrong with people when they showed up?
Well, Dr. Kellogg was really fixated on digestion, and he really believed that the colon was kind of the heart of human health and well-being. And he bought into this theory called auto-intoxication. And this was the idea that undigested food that remained in the colon for too long would poison not only the colon, but the entire body. And that's why he had this real emphasis on regularity and getting the food through. They also used enemas quite a bit in order to clean out people's system. So this whole idea of detoxing goes back to the early 19th century. Now, Kellogg was a little bit more inventive about this. He used not only water enemas, but he was excited by yogurt. And the thing he was excited about was that the countries where yogurt was consumed seemed to have longer lifespans than other places. And so he attributed this to the constituents of yogurt, but the fact that it also had living bacterial cultures in it. And so he was interested in manipulating the flora of the gut long, again, before this becomes mainstream. But he thought he could do this either by eating yogurt or by using yogurt as an enema.
Wow. Now, this was a very appealing place, right? There are a lot of famous people came. Could you tell us about some of those folks?
Some presidents came. Taft came at a certain point. Henry Ford was very interested in some of the ideas of John Harvey Kellogg. Explorers came, movie stars occasionally came. He also catered to really the kind of elite of the United States. I mean, the prices tended to be a little bit on the high side for a room, $10 to $20 a day. So the interesting thing is the Battle Creek Sanitarium began as a Seventh-day Adventist institution for Seventh-day Adventists, But slowly but surely over the years, Dr. Kellogg really opened it up to anybody who wanted to come. And he courted the rich and the famous because he knew that they could actually get the word out and spread his ideas.
Right. And were they satisfied customers?
Most were. Most were very satisfied and kept coming back season after season. It became a kind of watering hole in that sense without the alcohol. And people really look forward to their time at the Battle Creek Sanitarium. That wasn't always the case. And there's one very famous exception to this. There was a man named C.W. Post. And C.W. Post was a failed businessman from Texas who had digestive issues. And so he came and checked himself into the Battle Creek Sanitarium, but apparently he just hated the place from the beginning, and he didn't like Dr. Kellogg. But he really liked the cereal products that were available.
Right.
And he and his wife managed to get the recipes and the manufacturing process, you know, the secrets of that, while they were staying at the sanitarium and then left. And then Post turned around and created the Post Cereal Company, which was really the first successful breakfast cereal company in Battle Creek. And that set off a boom that lasted for years.
And sounds as if Kellogg is developing this kind of empire. Does that put him at tension with the church? I mean, you talk about how he's now courting the well-bred and well-fed. Does he have a rift with the church?
He does. Kellogg was always concerned about the harmony of science and religion. And in the early 20th century, Seventh-day Adventism became increasingly fundamentalist in its approach and in its rejection of, like, Darwinian evolution. And Kellogg, who was always mindful of his reputation as a doctor, really didn't want to be seen as somebody who was anti-science. And so he developed a theology, a kind of immanent theology of God, that harmonized for him better with his understanding of the development of science. And this put him at odds with the Seventh-day Adventist Church. In 1907, he was disfellowshipped. He was basically kicked out of the Seventh-day Adventist Church.
So, you know, part of that era, these ideas of Darwinism, but also of health, it led Kellogg to have some relationship to eugenics?
Yes. Well, eugenics, of course, is this idea that you can control human reproduction such that only people who have, quote unquote, good genetics can basically pass their genes on. And this was thought to be a way to improve the human race. And it's interesting because Seventh-day Adventism also taught that from the days of Adam and Eve, that human beings had been degenerating in terms of their lifespans. Because according to the Old Testament, Adam and Eve and the patriarchs lived for just phenomenal periods of time. And then slowly but surely, human beings, their lifespans became less and less. And one of the interpretations of this was that human beings were eating a bad diet and basically abusing their bodies. And the idea was by doing that, you were passing on defective genes. And so the race was actually, the human race was actually degenerating over time. And Kellogg was concerned because he felt that in the 19th century, so many more, he called them race poisons, things like tobacco and alcohol and meat were becoming more and more available to more and more of the population. And this was accelerating the degeneration of the human race.
Alcoholism, the opium habit, and tobaccoism are a trio of poison habits which have been weighty handicaps to human progress during the last three centuries. In the United States, the subtle spell of opium has been broken by restrictive legislation. The grip of the rum demon has been loosened by the Prohibition Amendment to the Constitution. But the tobacco habit still maintains its stranglehold, and more than 100 million victims of tobaccoism daily burn incense to the smoke god.
He basically talked about a kind of biological apocalypse, if you will, that the human race, if it continued on its path, would eventually become extinct.
We began our conversation talking about cornflakes, but that's a different Kellogg.
Yeah, no, you're correct. In the 1890s, Kellogg and his wife, Ella Eaton Kellogg, got together with Kellogg's brother, Will K. Kellogg, And Will K. Kellogg at that point was the business manager of the Battle Creek Sanitarium. And obviously a brilliant, brilliant businessman, but always lived in the shadow of his brother. Well, the three of them got together in an effort to design foods that would be more palatable to their guests. And after much experimentation, they came up with this idea of flattening out grains and baking them and creating essentially what we know today as breakfast cereals. The problem was Dr. Kellogg, he always had a health food a company associated with the Battle Creek Sanitarium, but he really didn't want to exploit this commercially because he was afraid that it would hurt his reputation as a doctor. But after C.W. Post managed to purloin the recipes and make a fortune, Will K. Kellogg basically had a falling out with his brother because Will K. Kellogg wanted to basically exploit Kellogg's cornflakes as a national brand. And so this became very, very acrimonious over the years, and the two brothers fought over who got to use the Kellogg name and unfortunately never reconciled, even up until Dr. Kellogg died in 1943.
Wow. There are things that we still believe today that Kellogg introduced to us. Can you give us the best case that we can make for Kellogg's positive, enduring legacy?
Well, I think the major thing that Kellogg should be remembered for is his emphasis on holistic health, on the connection between mind, body, and spirit for optimum wellness. And he really believed that you needed to basically focus on all three things to be a healthy and happy human being. It's interesting because medicine has always been as much an art as a science, and so a lot of it is trial and error. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what we remember Dr. Kellogg for are some of the things he didn't quite get right or some of the treatments we know that are counterproductive. But there are a lot of other things that he did that continue to be practiced today. For example, he was very concerned about people's digestion. And of course, he wanted people to be regular, and that became kind of a theme of his. And so one of the things he developed was the use of psyllium seeds as a bulk fiber. And of course, that's the basis for things like Metamucil today.
Huh.
So some of his practices, like his he promoted UV light, which he thought was very helpful to the body. And of course, we know that, you know, it's not. But on the other hand, he had some good ideas as well.
Brian C. Wilson is a professor of American Religious History at Western Michigan University. He's also the author of the book, Dr. John Harvey Kellogg and the Religion of Biologic Living. Hey, Brian, I've got a quick question. Why did you become a historian?
The stupendous pay and the wardrobe.
That's interesting, Brian. That's not what I would have guessed as your motivations. Is it possible that your fascination with the past might instead come from childhood regrets that you haven't been able to move on from, thus giving you an unconscious predisposition to this field of history? Is that possible?
So you're saying I'm a historian because of my inability to overcome my own past. Don't you think you're a little overanalyzing things here, Ed?
Well, you would say that, and that's kind of revealing in itself. Instead, I'm psychoanalyzing. That's the theory with its focus on the interplay between childhood, behavioral development, and the unconscious mind, created by Sigmund Freud in the 1890s. And according to scholar Gail Hornstein, psychoanalysis has had a special appeal here in America ever since Freud was invited to give a series of lectures at Clark University in 1909.
The president of the university in Worcester, Massachusetts, was G. Stanley Hall, a very illustrious, even at that time, American psychologist who had very radical ideas about psychology. It was a very daring act for G. Stanley Hall to invite Freud to give these lectures. In 1909, Freud was barely known in Europe and almost entirely unknown in America. But his radical ideas about the mind, and especially about sexuality, had earned him a certain degree of critique. Freud was given the premier slot in the organization of the conference. He alone gave a lecture every day of the week of the conference. Freud did not prepare these lectures in advance. Each morning, he took a walk around the neighborhood of Clark University and formulated his ideas. And then he delivered, extemporaneously and with no notes, what were widely considered to be jewels of clarity. He gave one lecture per day, each on a different topic, and essentially summarized the key ideas of his theory up to that point.
In Europe, I felt as though I were despised. But over there, I found myself received by the foremost men as an equal. As I stepped onto the platform at Worcester to deliver my five lectures upon psychoanalysis, it seemed like the realization of some incredible daydream. Psychoanalysis was no longer a product of delusion. It had become a valuable part of reality.
The fact that Freud chose, I think brilliantly, to give a overall accessible summary of his ideas rather than a set of technical, more complex presentations that assumed any prior knowledge is what helped these lectures to take on such a prominent importance. You can directly trace the spread of psychoanalysis in America to these Clark lectures. Prior to the introduction of psychoanalysis in America, what we really had were what are sometimes lumped together and called the mind cures. Freud's ideas were far more complicated and nuanced than those of other thinkers of the time who valued introspection or who thought about people's own experience as important. Because of the key notion, the core fundamental principle in psychoanalysis of the unconscious. The unconscious is what prevents us from understanding the roots of our problems, and it is only through a very painstaking process of unraveling that it's possible to get to the actual, the real, the hidden causes of suffering at the surface.
America is a mistake. A gigantic mistake, it is true, but a mistake.
Freud was never a big fan of America. Freud found America somewhat barbaric. He hated the food. It upset his stomach. He couldn't really understand the combination of prudery and licentiousness that came to dominate the culture. And Freud was very much, in a personal sense, a distinguished European of the 19th century, and America seemed a bit too rough and ready for his taste, and he very, very reluctantly realized that America was the place that psychoanalysis was actually going to most thrive for a whole set of other historical reasons, and Americans ought to be supported in their interest in psychoanalysis, but he himself never wanted to come back to America, and he wished, I think, at some level, that England had been a bigger country so that more of psychoanalysis could be institutionalized there. Freud's ideas did not immediately gain currency in America after his 1909 lectures at Clark. But it was really after World War II that these ideas came to have a much wider cultural currency. And this was largely because a great number of psychiatrists and psychologists were called into service during World War II to cope with the suffering of soldiers, the kind of suffering we would now call PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome. And the core idea of psychoanalysis, that someone can experience a trauma, but then they can work through that trauma by talking through those issues in a complex way with a trained analyst. This idea was very, very important to the physicians who were serving in treating soldiers during the Second World War.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you will permit me to generalize as is indispensable in so brief a presentation, we may express our results up to this point in the formula. our hysterical patients suffer from reminiscences. Their symptoms are the remnants and the memory symbols of certain traumatic experiences.
What was most radical about Freud's ideas at the time was that he took seriously the experience of suffering patients who, at the time, were predominantly women. Women were seen by most other physicians to be fantasists who made up things or malingerers who pretended to have physical symptoms that they didn't really have. And Freud took seriously, in the deepest possible way, what it was that patients in general, and these women in particular, had to say about what was happening in their minds. The suffering patient who might be inarticulate, unable to identify what it was that was causing his or her problems, could be taken seriously, and from what the patient said, the underlying causes of their distress could be, with the help of the psychoanalyst, unraveled.
What's a Freudian slip? It's when you say one thing and mean your mother.
Psychoanalysis also comes to take a place in the popular culture starting in the 1950s, and we see the ubiquitous cartoons of someone lying on a couch and someone with a beard sitting behind them, and many, many other forms of popular representation. The thing that's so important to stress about this that I think people often miss about psychoanalysis when they think about sort of the dour Freud talking about the struggle of life, the sense of psychoanalysis being optimistic, which during the 1950s and 1960s really seen as one of its key aspects, that you could change things no matter who you were as an adult and no matter what you had been through earlier in your life, you could work that through and you could have a normal adulthood. This was a very, very exciting and positive and uplifting kind of idea to many, many people. Almost all forms of psychotherapy that exist in the United States are derivations of psychoanalytic theory. And I think understanding oneself is something that people will always want to do. And the optimistic aspect of psychoanalysis, even though it's very difficult to go through, that one can really change one's life and not be stuck in one's fate, even if traumatic, is something that will never go away.
Gil Hornstein is Professor Emerita of Psychology and Education at Mount Holyoke College. So, Brian, I noticed a recurring theme through all these different episodes in the story of wellness in America. It's always a battle in some ways over who's in charge, mm-hmm. who has the authority to tell us how to be well. And I just wonder, you know, do you agree with that? And if you do, well, what sort of pattern do you see in that claim of expertise?
Well, I noticed that theme, so I agree with you, Ed. Mm-hmm. And I also noticed a recurring period of time, which I'm told we're supposed to pay attention to as historians.
Yes, time's important.
That period between the Civil War and, let's say, the 1920s, it seemed like there's just a lot up for grabs, and it seems like many of our segments kind of go back to that period. So here's my theory about the time period and the theme.
Okay.
To oversimplify a bit, I think that spiritual and moral authority is in pretty good shape for the first two-thirds of the 19th century. In fact, I've learned from you that religiosity actually intensified
sure.
in the 1820s and 1830s. But I think after the Civil War, those who are in charge of our moral and spiritual well-being, well, who that should be was really kind of up for grabs.
Well, why was that?
Well, I think the authority of ministers was being challenged. I think that a lot of Americans were uncomfortable with more and more women disproportionately filling the pews of churches. There was talk about religion becoming feminized. And after the terrible carnage of the Civil War, by the end of the 19th century, I think there was a little bit of concern that perhaps we were growing soft, that we really needed to demonstrate our kind of masculine Christianity, so to speak.
So that suggests that the concern with wellness doesn't really grow from a less well population. Do you think there's a correlation between the need for wellness and our concern with it, or is this something generated out of something else in the culture?
Well, I think if we fast forward to the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century, I do think it's fair to say that it has something to do with wellness because people are living longer,
right,
and they're expecting to live longer. And even more than that, they're expecting to feel good well into their 60s and 70s. So I think that's a period in which the term wellness, for me, really seems to apply.
But before that, people are just determined, hoping to stay alive.
Yeah. And if you look at the average lifespan, it turns out that we are living longer. And there's good reason to believe in the new authority, including kind of a moral authority on the block. And that's doctors, that's science.
Brian, anybody who has looked at American culture after World War II, it seems like you see sort of traces of Freudianism everywhere, you know? Everybody understands about what it means to get on the couch, right?
Yeah.
And go to see a shrink and, you know, and Woody Allen jokes and all that. So there seems to have been a long-standing fascination with or adoption of Freudian ideas. Do you think the United States was especially searching for that kind of expertise?
Well, I think that the United States found in a kernel of Freud's theory an approach that meshed really well with American individualism and that was powered.
That we all have our own unique problems?
That's exactly right.
Huh.
As the end of that segment we heard pointed to, there was a real optimism, which I'm not sure Freud entirely shared himself, given his success rate. But what was taken from Freud was the popularization of a kind of optimistic sense that one can improve themselves, which, you know, Ed, existed in the United States long before Freud ever came over.
And is one of the great through lines of all the things that we're talking about. The idea of wellness in America is that you can, in fact, become more well.
That's
right. And that it's our right. And in some ways, even our obligation to become more well. And so I think, you know, Freud embodied a certain kind of wholeness, you know, that we've been looking for in other ways ever since. If we'd eat this diet, then we'd be complete. You know, if we would figure out this technique of child rearing, we would all be well.
That's right. And not only have we imbibed kind of the basic tenets of Freudian psychology, we even have terms like reverse psychology. It's such a given, these psychological expectations that we have counter psychology, reverse psychology. It's very much woven into our culture.
Yeah, I've heard so much about this, I kind of have a complex about it, right? That's kind of, so how do we get to the present day then if we have these sort of contestations? You had a doctor like Kellogg and then another doctor like Freud who are claiming this expertise at least out of some sort of institutional base, right? Today, the people who seem to be telling us what to do are people who have no claim whatsoever to that, but are successful and happy. And I think about Gwyneth Paltrow and her infamous company Goop, in which she's imagining all kinds of beneficial effects from most unlikely kinds of techniques and substances and so forth. But we also look to Oprah Winfrey, other people like that, to tell us how not just to be healthy, but to be well. We have more experts than ever now, Brian. So why would we turn to popular culture figures for our source of expertise?
Because that expertise has not solved all of our physical problems, for one. I turn on the television, and I will confess, I watch kind of mainly cable network news and C-SPAN, which doesn't have commercials.
We're all deeply surprised.
Right, exactly. Now, C-SPAN doesn't have commercials, but cable network news does, and almost everything advertised these days, it ranges from indigestion to rather esoteric diseases that still exist, is my point. And so those experts haven't solved everything, even though we're living longer and presumably a little bit more healthy, but they haven't solved that problem we started with, which is moral authority. How do we feel spiritually good about ourselves? Well, one way we do it is we jog. We go to the gym. Now, doctors will recommend exercise, but the people who have popularized that are people that we can really identify with, not because we drive in limousines or we have millions of dollars, but we see them on television. They're those celebrities that you know a lot more about than I do.
Yeah, it's interesting. The celebrities that we seem to turn to now don't ask anything of us other than to buy their products. Now, at least when there was Jane Fonda, she wanted us to work out and sweat, right? And I'm sure buy leggings and leotards too. And I know that you've actually had a dalliance with the aerobics craze, right? Is that right, Brian?
Well, dalliance may be an overstatement, Ed. And it came about because my doctor actually suggested that I get more exercise. And so I signed up for an aerobics class. And in many ways, this takes us back to the beginning of the discussion, Ed, because I discovered just how gendered that aerobics class, and I gather most, were. So this was taught at Intramural Rec. I show up at the old, unair-conditioned, I might add, gym at UVA.
I'm impressed already, Brian.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you would have been less impressed if you saw me, because I just wore my regular sweatpants, and to make matters worse, I forgot my sneakers. So I figured, what could be the big deal? I just show up in my socks. Well, I was the only guy in a class of like 30 people. Everybody stared at me and then looked at my footwear.
Yeah, I've had that dream. Speaking of Freud.
This was a nightmare. And it seemed to me that everybody in the class had taken at least 15 other aerobics classes, because they certainly were moving around to rhythm, which I was not, even if I hadn't been sliding around the class. So I was so embarrassed. I never went back again. Part of it was poor wardrobe choice, but most
of it— That's never stopped you before.
It has not. But most of it was being the only guy in this class of all women. And it never even occurred to me.
Not only being the only guy, but also being the least adept to what everybody was doing,
right?
Well,
that also is not the first time I was the least adept. But this really underscored what a lot of the second wave feminists criticized about aerobics, that everybody was thin in this class. Everybody was already in good shape. And they use the term on display. I don't know how the women felt, but boy, did I feel on display. It's almost as though I needed years of therapy to get over that experience, Ed.
Well, it almost worked out. You seem very well to me now, Brian.
That'll do it for us today. Thanks for joining me to take a look back at the Backstory Archive. There are hundreds of other shows available at our website, backstoryradio.org. You can keep the conversation going online. Let us know what you thought of an episode, or ask us your question about history. Send us an email at backstory@virginia.edu. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, at Backstory Radio. Backstory is produced at Virginia Humanities. Major support is provided by an anonymous donor. the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Joseph and Robert Cornell Memorial Foundation, the Johns Hopkins University, and the Arthur Vining Davis Foundations. Additional support is provided by the Tomato Fund, cultivating fresh ideas in the arts, the humanities, and the environment.
Brian Ballow is Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Ed Ayers is Professor of the Humanities and President Emeritus of the University of Richmond. Joanne Freeman is Professor of History and American Studies at Yale University. Nathan Connolly is the Herbert Baxter Adams Associate Professor of History at the Johns Hopkins University. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for Virginia Humanities.